Mr. Campbell.
Morning, Your Honors, Counsel. Terry Campbell of Cotsarillos Tie and Striker on behalf of Defendant Tom Carroll in this case. Your Honors, we have what by any measure is a truly extraordinary result in this case. Thomas Carroll, who pled guilty to all counts in the indictment voluntarily, who had cooperated within a week of having been arrested, and who had a presumptive guideline sentencing range of 70 to 87 months, as recorded by the probation office, was sentenced instead to a 262-month term. It is a length of time which is greater than that which would be imposed on someone convicted of second-degree murder, of kidnapping, where there's a life-threatening injury, or even the sentence imposed on the most serious drug offenders. It is a sentence that is four times greater than the presumptive guideline range that applied to his offense, and it is a sentence which is seven times greater than that which was imposed upon his co-defendant and co-schemer in this case, who was involved in all of the same particulars that Mr. Carroll was, as well as having been...
Well, I recall that the co-defendant, however, had nothing to do with the United States government.
That's correct.
So that your client was representing the United States, the other client was not.
That is true. And, Your Honor, to be clear, the argument that we've made is not that the sentences of the co-defendants must be equal in any respect. What we've said, though, is that if there are going to be differences, and there are reasons for differences between the sentences of the defendants in this case, it has to be based on a reasoned application of the guidelines and the law. And here, there are reasons for differences in the sentences. Perhaps one reason is that Mr. Carroll was employed by the federal government while Haleem Khan was not. Another reason that's certainly apparent in the record is that Haleem Khan was granted a 5K departure for cooperation while Mr. Carroll was not. But those do not explain the 19-year difference in the sentences between these two co-defendants. Mr. Khan, I would add, was also convicted and sentenced on a wholly separate alien smuggling scheme that Mr. Carroll had nothing whatever to do with. And the thing that makes, one of the things that makes manifest the problem with the sentence is that prior to Mr. Carroll's plea, there was a plea agreement that had been worked out where the government had agreed that 57 months was the appropriate sentence. The government had agreed that Mr. Carroll had accepted responsibility. The government had agreed
that
there was no...
That was never implemented.
That was never implemented,
because the government wouldn't.
No, it was not because the government wouldn't. In fact, the government had signed off on that plea agreement. Mr. Carroll, on the advice of his counsel at trial, Mr. Nagelberg, chose to enter a blind plea rather than enter that plea agreement, and really for one reason, and that was because the government was not giving him a 5K motion for substantial assistance. Now, you can look back at that and say, well, that was wrong.
Of course, the agreement itself doesn't bind the judge.
The agreement itself does not bind the judge, but...
So you're complaining against the action of the judge, not against the action of the government.
What I'm complaining about is the action of the judge, but what I'm saying is that that plea agreement certainly sheds light on what the appropriate sentence was and what the true facts of this case are in terms of their application under the application of the guidelines to them. If I could turn to the first issue we addressed, which I think highlights clearly the one of the problems with the court's decision, and that is on the obstruction issue. The obstruction enhancement that the court gave to Mr. Carroll here was based on a single statement that Mr. Carroll purportedly made to the probation office, where he said that he believed, after having been in the MCC for 20 months and not having any financial records in front of him, and he made those points clear to the probation officer, he believed that he had up to $100,000 in legitimate savings over the course of his 10-year professional life. And included in that was $28,000 that his wife had brought into the marriage. The probation officer reported that in the PSR, said that he had indicated that he had $28,000 from his wife and up to $100,000 in legitimate assets. He also said at that same time I commingled those funds in the same accounts with the money that I derived from my visa fraud scheme. That was the one and only statement that Mr. Carroll made with respect to this, and it was the one and only basis that the court granted the obstruction enhancement for. I would like, for purposes of the argument today, to put aside whether or not anyone can dispute whether those statements are false. We've argued in our brief that the statement was not false in any way, and I think that's clear. But even if you accept the government's position that it was false, even if you accept that, it cannot support an obstruction enhancement because it was not, and it could not be material to any fact that was in dispute. And the simple reason is this. When he pled blind, Mr. Carroll pled blind not only to all three substantive counts of the indictment, but he also pled to the forfeiture count. The forfeiture count in the indictment alleged $1.7 million. Mr. Carroll, at his plea, agreed to forfeit $2.5 million. There is no dispute that he forfeited everything he had. The probation officer found that he had a negative net worth. The court, knowing everything that it knew, did not impose a fine. There was no issue of restitution. Everything Mr. Carroll had was taken from him. And even if you assume that what he said to the probation officer, as reflected by the court's decision, that I have $100,000 in legitimate assets, it makes no difference. As the government pointed out in the district court, we're entitled to get substitute assets. So it doesn't matter if he got that $100,000 from his grandmother, and it's pure as the driven snow, that $100,000 is forfeitable because he agreed to a forfeiture of $2.5 million. That statement, even if you take it as having been false, which we obviously don't agree or concede, could not be material. And that was the one and only basis for the obstruction enhancement. And as I said, the government makes the case on that as well as we do in their briefs below, when they said to the court, it doesn't matter. It does not matter. Substitute assets are just as forfeitable. This, again, I would just point the court to the cases that, some of the cases that we cited in our reply brief in particular, which talk about these types of issues, the Fiala case, the Parker case, and the Fenn case, all of which look at statements which, even if you accept, are false, are not and cannot be material, and therefore cannot be the basis for an obstruction enhancement. Tied into that obstruction enhancement was the court's denial of acceptance of responsibility to Mr. Carroll. The court based its denial of acceptance of responsibility on one primary factor, and that was that she had granted this obstruction enhancement, and secondarily, on a claim that Mr. Carroll did not fully admit his involvement in the scheme at his plea. I would submit that both of those were clearly erroneous findings. First, the obstruction enhancement, as we just discussed, cannot apply to Mr. Carroll's case based on the one false statement, or one allegedly false statement, that the court relied on. With respect to the second and secondary basis for the denial of acceptance of responsibility, the court said that Mr. Carroll was not fully forthcoming, essentially, at his plea colloquy. And I would ask Your Honors to read the transcript. Mr. Carroll was asked at his plea hearing to state in his own words what he did. He went through count by count, and I think it covers three pages of transcript, what he had done as to each of those counts. And with respect to each of them, the court found that that was a sufficient basis to find him guilty of those. The government then recited its factual basis, which was essentially reading what had been in the plea agreement. And it went on for many pages of transcript, many pages. And when the government finished, the court turned to Mr. Carroll and said, is that right? Mr. Carroll said, well, there are some things that are wrong. The court said, what? He said, well, my title wasn't this, my title was that. He said, there are some other details that are wrong. And the court said to him, point blank, is anything in there inconsistent with your plea of guilty to these counts? He said, no. Does anything take away from your guilt on these counts? He said, no. The court then asked him, are you guilty of count one? Yes. Are you guilty of count two? Yes. Are you guilty of count three? Yes. The government says now he minimized his role. He didn't talk about everything that was involved in this scheme at his plea hearing. Well, I would invite your honors, please, please look at what we've attached in the appendix to our reply brief, and that is the 20-some-odd page, single-spaced proffer that Mr. Terrell gave within 30 days, beginning 7 days after he was arrested. He gave a detailed, detailed statement. He met with the government 9 times in the 3 months following his arrest. If you look at that proffer, you cannot come away with any conclusion, anything other than that Mr. Terrell fully admitted his culpability in these offenses, fully accepted his responsibility for those offenses. The government on one hand says he didn't admit enough at his plea colloquy. He didn't talk about all the other people who were involved. And yet when they talk about what was said in the proffer, this detailed proffer where he names everybody who he had dealt with, where he lists out every bank account that he has, where he tells them where they can find the money and the assets that he has acquired, where he gives them combinations to his safes, where he tells them what money he had given away to his family. They say, well, he said too much there. He told us about all these other people. We wanted to know about him. At his plea, he tells them about him and him alone, and it's found fully sufficient by the court. The government cannot have it both ways. The court's findings on the obstruction enhancement and the acceptance of responsibility reduction simply cannot withstand any scrutiny. It is, again, interesting that the only thing that changed between the offered plea agreement, which called for a 57-month sentence, which called for a three-point reduction for acceptance of responsibility, which said there was no obstruction, which didn't ask for any upward departures, the only difference, the only thing that happened, the only intervening event, was that rather than sign the plea agreement, Mr. Terrell pled guilty to every count without the plea agreement. That is not a reason to go from a 57-month sentence to a 262-month sentence. It is simply not justified under any basis. We have similar problems with the 4 upward departures that were granted by the court. Again, none of those were asked for in the plea agreement, which was offered to the defendant and signed off on by the government. And with respect to the 3 upward departures that we have challenged, as you see from the briefs, there are both legal and factual errors in those upward departures. There is a myriad of places where the court double counts things. And I will give you one example which highlights both of those facts. The court repeatedly talks about the fact that no background checks were done by Mr. Terrell, and that simply is not consistent with the evidence at trial. In fact, the government's witnesses testified that Mr. Terrell did a background check on every one of these people.
Did it make any difference?
I'm sorry?
Did he apply the background check? Did he deny a visa to those who may not otherwise have gotten them?
Absolutely,
you know, they bribed?
Your Honor. Yes, absolutely.
So he just turned back the bribe or whatever?
Yes, Your Honor, that was the evidence. Mr. Terrell did turn away people if they did not pass the background check, and in fact, the undercover officer who went down there to gather evidence against Mr. Terrell was told specifically by Mr. Terrell, run these background checks, and if they don't pass them, do not issue a visa. So the answer to that question is yes, absolutely.
If I You're in your rebuttal time.
Yes, if I could reserve the rest. Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear now from Mr. Bookbinder.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Noah Bookbinder for the United States. Your Honors, this is in no way a typical bribery case. This is a case in which Thomas Terrell sold improperly so many visas and denied other visas that ought to have been granted properly that he essentially discredited the entire visa issuance system at the U.S. Embassy in Georgetown, Guyana.
Hold on just a minute. Is there anything that you know now that you didn't know when the plea agreement was signed off by the government?
There are several things that changed between...
Well, was there anything you know now, or you know at the time of the sentencing, that you didn't know at the time you signed off on the plea agreement?
Specifically Thomas Carroll's obstructive conduct.
Which was
twofold, actually. It was to contest at the plea hearing and beyond the forfeiture of six brokerage accounts, which he claimed had legitimate funds, and then following that to...
But that's all?
You
had access to that anyway, didn't you?
I'm sorry?
You would have had, the government would have had access to those funds at any rate, would they not? Would the government have access to them?
I believe that ultimately the government would have prevailed.
Hold on a minute. What I want to know is what evidence that would lead to such a draconian increase came to the attention of the government between the time of the proffer and the time of the sentence.
Well, there are several factors that led to the changes in the government's position and the district court's position.
What different facts? Factors. Facts.
The only facts that were different were both the obstructive...
We've already discussed that one.
Yeah.
Anything else?
And the additional information and cooperation that Thomas Carroll would have had to, under the plea agreement, give. He was obligated, for instance, to testify in front of the grand jury. Obviously, he did not do so. And that could have assisted the government both in tracking down additional of the people who are out there somewhere in this country based on improper visas given by Thomas Carroll, and also very possibly into tracking down additional proceeds of these visa fraud schemes. There also was the fact that at the contested sentencing hearing, the government had to put on testimony by, among others, a man named Hargobin Mortley, who was a Guyanese citizen who participated in this very dangerous group of paramilitary police that Thomas Carroll worked with called the Black Shirts. And in so testifying, Mortley put himself in danger of probably being, or possibly at least being killed by these people if he ever went back to Guyana. That is something that would not have had to happen if Thomas Carroll had accepted the plea agreement.
And that fact was enunciated to the court as one of the reasons that she should increase the sentence.
Well, I believe that was enunciated to the court in terms of the opposition to the acceptance of responsibility, among other factors, and to the issues of danger to public welfare and use of violence. I think that was...
That was not part of the proffer, that he didn't tell you about that before?
He certainly told some about having worked with these people before, but the impact on the government and its witnesses from having to go forward with extensive sentencing hearings was something which was not clear beforehand. There is also, on the obstruction issue, as far as the forfeiture of that money, the fact that Judge Manning ordered the government to extensively brief the forfeiture of those six contested accounts. So
he gets an extra sentence because you had to work harder preparing the brief?
It's not that, Your Honor.
It's an interesting concept, anyway.
And that's not what I meant to imply. What I am saying is that clearly this was an issue that the district court saw as being in question. And these facts as to whether this money was legitimate or not as being material to the point that they had to be extensively briefed by both parties. The Seventh Circuit has said in...
I'm familiar with the circuit.
This court has said in the Buckley case, which is cited in the government's brief at 710, that one of the points of the obstruction enhancement is to reduce the burden on the system. In other words, if somebody goes out and makes false statements, that puts the pressure on the system to go out and prove those statements to be false.
If an issue is, well, he didn't prove it false as much as you proved that it didn't make any difference.
For several things, it may have made a difference. For instance, I have two separate points on that. First of all, it may have made a difference in the sense that if the government found additional money, which the government has consistently believed is out there, it would affect what could be taken and what could not.
Well, did you find any?
No, Your Honor.
You just have a kind of a vague feeling there is some money out there.
Well, based on
all the money you got.
The extensive testimony as to the numbers of visas that were sold and the amount of money paid for them, the government believes there's strong evidence that there's additional money out there. Thomas Carroll, in his in whatever talks he had with the government, didn't say where any extra money was. Also, there's the issue of fines and restitution, which are based on ability to pay, and whether he had legitimate assets could be material to that. But there are also a number of cases out there that make clear that whether a fact ultimately is or could be dispositive is not the issue. The issue is whether it's relevant, whether the court should consider it. For instance, in the Small case cited in the government's brief, it's a D.C. Circuit case, a defendant purposely omitted to tell the court about a house that defendant owned, which turned out to have no equity, and therefore it didn't ultimately impact the defendant's financial situation. But home ownership is a factor that's relevant to consideration in making fine, restitution, forfeiture decisions, just as whether there are legitimate bank accounts out there and whether there is legitimate money out there are relevant and therefore material.
Have you subsequently discovered that he was hiding assets?
Well, we discovered that there were assets that he did not talk about in his proffer sessions that the government subsequently found. In fact, the assets that he talked about in his proffer sessions were those that had already been seized by the government. One such issue was, which the appellants point out in their reply brief, was an issue regarding an account in Barbados. And the appellants state, well, actually, if you look at the proffer, he did say he had an account in Barbados, and that's true. But if you look in the government's forfeiture brief, which is Record 104, at the uncontested accounts by that point, much later in the proceedings, it makes clear that there were two accounts in Barbados at the Scotia Bank. So, and in the proffer, Thomas Carroll says there was one. He also says in his proffer that he used his State Department Federal Credit Union only for depositing his salary. But again, that government's forfeiture brief makes clear that the evidence shows that he actually did launder fraudulently obtained money through that account. So he was consistently going through and trying to minimize the amount of dirty money that the government found and was aware of. And in addition, as to the willfulness of the false statements that he made, there are a couple of factors that are important to consider. One is that of these six accounts which Thomas Carroll contested, he didn't have any of them prior to the start of the visa fraud scheme. In fact, he opened up those accounts at the same time that he opened up many of the other accounts that he conceded were opened for the purpose of depositing money relevant to the scheme. And in fact, a detailed financial analysis, which was submitted to the district court in the sentencing hearing, makes clear that when Thomas Carroll and his wife went down to Guyana, they had maybe up to $5,000 in legitimate savings. Down in Guyana, he only made $65,000 legitimately, and he spent at least that much. We're not talking about a difference between him saying he had some money and in fact he had a little bit less. We're talking about him saying he had some money when he had none that came from legitimate sources. There's no need to have extensive documents on hand to know the difference between some and none. And in fact, the district court notes that Mr. Carroll's discovery requests were complied with by the government, and he doesn't argue otherwise. There's no reason to believe that he didn't know what his finances were.
Well, Binder, if I may switch focus just a little
sure.
bit. With respect to this question, the government wasn't the district court under some misapprehension about security checks as to whether they had been performed or not?
I don't believe so. I think that actually, the appellants are, I believe, are mistaken when they assert that the government is raising a new point in its brief now, which is that essentially the background checks were more or less useless because Thomas Carroll had no way of knowing who these people were and whether their identifications were legitimate. Whether the identifications identified them by their true names. And if in reading the district court's decision, the district court specifically refers to the false identification documents used by many of the visa applicants. And now, Thomas Carroll...
Did these folks come with the false identification, or did he actually produce them for them?
What Thomas Carroll helped refer them to someone to produce were false supporting documents, which were documents such as letters saying that the person had employment. But where Mr. Carroll was in a situation where he knew that these people were unscrupulous enough to pay a lot of money to get visas that they likely otherwise wouldn't get, and he was unscrupulous enough to send them to someone else for false supporting documents, and there is government testimony that fake passports were readily obtainable in Guyana, there's just no reason that we should believe, or he would have believed, that there was any reliability to the passports
just
that people brought in.
Because these were disreputable people.
Well, because everything that was going on was fake. The granting of the visas was paid for. The documents that Thomas Carroll was helping them to make were fake.
Is there any indication that folks who came in who had not bribed him with legitimate visa seekers, that they were any less tainted by the local culture, and that did he go through some kind of a security check with them to make sure he had the right person before he ran a security check that he didn't with respect to these people? Did these people, in other words, get preferential treatment with respect to the security check?
I think these people, I think the same checks were run for everyone. However, there was a key difference between the two groups of people.
Please, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
And that difference was that the group of people who were paying for visas were already knowingly doing something illegal and were getting other false documents with Thomas Carroll's help. So there was much more reason to be suspicious of their visas, of their passports and other documents. If Mr. Carroll wanted to be careful, then clearly more diligence would have been in order.
But he apparently exercised the same diligence he did with other individuals.
Well, yes. And in fact
did deny one, am I correct?
I believe he denied a few people. But there's a reason why it might have been in his interest to do so, which is that same background check that he was running could be, and I believe was run at other stages in the process, and if these people were picked up later as having been granted visas when a quick background check would have shown them to have, say, criminal conduct, that would have brought suspicion on
Mr.
Carroll.
The district court thought he wasn't running the background checks. Am I correct?
Well, the district court says that he didn't run effective background checks based on the use of false identification. So I think the district court clearly takes note of that position and that argument. I believe I'm out of time if the court has no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bookbinder.
Thank you.
Mr. Cavill, you have 2 minutes.
Well, I would just like to highlight a couple points. One is that the fact of the matter is there are no additional facts. There were no additional facts. There was nothing new that was presented to the government or the court in between the time when that plea agreement was offered by the government for a 57-month sentence and the time that they went to the sentencing hearing and suddenly changed their position that now no longer was a 5-year sentence appropriate but a 22-year sentence.
Well, were you your client willing to go before a grand jury as pursuant to the plea agreement?
Is he at this point?
Or was he at the time of the sentencing willing to go forward?
At the time of the sentencing, that was not the sticking point. The sticking point was...
Whether it was or wasn't, was there any volunteer, I shall rush into the grand jury and follow through on the program I offered?
He had no objection to following through on that program, as you see.
Did he offer to do so?
Did he offer to do so at the time of his blind plea? He did not specifically offer to do so at the time of his blind plea. Mm-hmm. He also did not, as the government has asserted both in its brief and here, contest forfeiture. They keep saying he contested forfeiture. He pled to the forfeiture count, and not only did he plead to the forfeiture count, he pled to $800,000 more than what was in the indictment. There was no contesting
forfeiture. What point of the government's position did he object to that caused him not to enter into the plea agreement?
The point that he objected to was the fact that they were not willing to give him a substantial assistance departure motion. Oh. When he had gone in for 9 separate proffer sessions, and as you see, gave them information about each and every aspect.
When you've answered the question, go ahead.
Okay. The fact of the matter is, as well, on the issue of obstruction, that there are no additional assets. The government testified before the district court that they had done an exhaustive investigation for more than a year at that point and found nothing. He identified everything, and again, I would point you to that proffer. You look through that. He identified everything. He had his family sign over whatever assets they had that they had gotten from him. And as far as the background checks, the only false documents there are documents that have to do with employment. There is no difference in the way that those people were treated as opposed to everyone else. And finally, all of these upward departures, as we pointed out in our briefs, are offense-based upward departures, not offender-based upward departures, and they cannot apply to Tom Carroll and not to Mr. Kahn. The correct decision was what was done with Mr. Kahn and what was offered to Mr. Carroll in his plea agreement. That is the correct application, and the sentence here is simply not just under any fair view of the facts of the law.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.